Welcome to
BirdWorld.com. A podcast for those involved in designing, developing, and running websites. This is what everybody waits for. Hello and welcome to the 85th episode of BoagWorld.com, a podcast for those involved in designing, developing and running websites on a daily basis. My name is Paul Boag and here is my co-host, Marcus Leamington. Hello, Marcus.
Hello, Paul. How are you today? How's your back?
My back is painful.
Paul got beaten up by a 12-year-old, wasn't it?
No, he's 15. But he was 6'5" and he didn't mean to beat me up. So that's got to count for something, hasn't it?
I guess.
Yeah, so guess what?
What?
It's exciting, this is. Right. Since last week's show went out, it has been downloaded, it has been uniquely downloaded 24,000 times.
Well, the last show?
Yeah, last show. 24,000.
Wow. Well, there's not a lot you can say to that, is there, apart from woohoo.
We're great. But if you think about that too much, it kind of, I mean, okay, it's not as big as Dignation and all the rest, but 24,000 times, that's pretty cool. But if you think about it too much, it kind of begins to freak you out. Like, imagine 24,000 people all together in one place at one time.
Oh, I've done all that before, Paul.
Oh, yeah. What was your biggest concert then, when you were a superstar?
The biggest thing we were ever involved with was 20,000, but that's not where I was thinking about it. It's when you think about the people that bought your record. We sold very nearly 1 million copies of the first album, and then you think about how many people was that?
Million copies over what length of time?
About 2 years.
Yeah, see, last month, the podcast, all of the episodes combined, were downloaded 140,000 times. So, we're just the same as you.
One back going on here.
Yeah. So it's like, I'm super smug. So do you know what I want to do now? In part of my media buying. I've been thinking about this, right? Media mogul or something. I don't know.
Right.
So yeah, my next plan is I think we ought to do a TV show. What?
Well, yeah, okay.
All right, great, good, great. So if anybody listening
you've
to this...
You mean a video cast?
No. Proper TV show. I'll tell you why, right?
Right.
I was sitting down watching TV with my wife, okay? Now, my wife's taste in TV is somewhat dubious, if you ask me. Although, admittedly, I do watch trash as well. But anyway...
So is your fault.
Yes. She was watching, what was it, Mary Queen of Shops. Have you heard of this?
No.
Right. So this is about a retail expert that goes into like boutique shops and does them up and makes them good again. It's basically like what's the one that the F word guy, what's his name?
Yeah.
Gordon Ramsay. He went and did that with people's businesses, didn't he?
Yep.
So
well, they're restaurants, yeah.
Yeah, well, these restaurants. Right. So she's doing it the same with shops, and I was thinking, who cares? Who cares about fashion boutique shops and being done up? So I figured,
no one cares. It's just good. It's entertaining watching people do it badly and the clash between the person coming in. That's what's the attraction of those shows.
Exactly. So why can't we do that about web design? It's a good idea. So
I can see the BBC stumping up thousands for that.
Thousands and thousands.
Billions.
Yeah. So if you are a TV producer and you listen to this show, okay, I think we better move on, really, because that's not going anywhere, is it? Oh, well.
The download figures have officially gone to Paul's heads, everyone.
Yeah!
Heads. There you go. You have two heads.
I've got more than one head. So there we go. Let's move on. I don't know. I'm probably too famous now to do the news, but I'll try.
Use your other head to do it.
Okay.
Call you Zaphod from now on.
I've got Zaphod's ego, so there we go. Birdworld.com. Okay, so it's time for me, the internet god of the world, to now bestow on you my wisdom about the news. No reaction from Marcus whatsoever.
Speechless.
Okay, so my first news story is, well, I say it's news story. It's actually not a news story at all. Well, actually, no, that's not true either. It's kind of a news story. Well, it's news to me. Does that count? Because I wasn't previously aware of it. But the actual post, I'll get to the point in a minute. The actual post was made back in December of last year. But the post relates to the most irritating of subjects, and that's why I'm including it, because it's such an important and irritating subject that I decided to include it. And the subject is The Fold. That, you know, that's mythical beast that is The Fold, the point where you start to scroll on the screen. And I've spoken a lot about The Fold before, I call it mythical because that point on the screen where you start to scroll changes depending on screen resolution, browser type, and scroll bars and that kind of stuff. So there is no real fold as such. It's a bit of a kind of made up thing. But the reason that it's so annoying is because it appears to me that clients are obsessed by it. They're convinced that users don't scroll, which is a perception rooted back in the early 90s somewhere. And no amount of persuasion seems to change their mind. However,
it's not just clients, Paul. I was at a session with another agency the other day, and they felt that, you know, particularly on a homepage, there should be nothing below the fold.
No.
Which fold was my response to that?
No, I better not ask. I'll ask later who that was. We won't name and shame them on the show. So anyway, hopefully I found a post this week which is going to help with that whole debate. It's called Unfolding the Fold, and it's posted by the guys over at Clicktail. Now, I mentioned Clicktail before. They're a service that actually monitors what people are doing in real time on their websites, what they're clicking on, how they're scrolling, that kind of stuff. And they provide in this blog post some hard stats about the fold and scrolling in general. So they demonstrate that the vast majority of people actually do scroll, well over 3/4 of the people scroll, and almost a lot of those people will actually scroll right to the bottom of the page. Now, the actual percentage is only 22% that scroll to the bottom of the page, which you go, well, that's really low, you know, but it is actually higher than that, because a lot of people are returning to pages they've already visited. And so they don't feel the need to scroll down to the bottom because they've already scrolled down there once. So anyway, the long and the short of this article is that their conclusion is that there's no real reason to squeeze all of your content above the fold, and that it's a complete misnomer and we shouldn't worry about it anymore. So that's my first news story of the day, and I think that's really useful. Go and check out the article. Obviously, as normal, boagworld.com/podcast, select show 85, and you can find the link to that article in there. Okay, next news story up. If you're in the UK on the 7th of September, you should be sure to come to the Deconstruct Web Design Conference. Deconstruct is, in my opinion, one of the best web design conferences around. The reason I like it so much is that it works hard to kind of have a grassroots feel that is accessible to anybody. For a start, the price ticket is a very accessible £85 plus VAT. Secondly, the whole thing happens on a single day, so there's no need for expensive hotel bills if that's going to be a problem. And then finally, they have a great mix of speakers. So they do have the big names that you'd expect, but they also have a lot of less well-known people in order to kind of shake up the scene, whatever that means. The reason that I mention about Deconstruct today is that the tickets are going to go on sale next Tuesday, so that's the 10th of July. Historically, they sell out incredibly fast, so that's why I'm giving you that week's warning head up. Literally, set a reminder for the 10th to check, because they will sell extremely quickly. Although, I have to say that they do have a venue that is much larger this year, so hopefully that will help somewhat. I really, really, really want to encourage you to attend this event if you possibly can. It will be exceptionally good. You really will get value for money. And I'll be there. And as we established, that's worth the price alone. And hopefully we can get together and meet up and stuff. Okay, enough of the big ego stuff now. Moving on to the next story. In fact, talking of Deconstruct, Richard Rutter, who's one of the organisers of Deconstruct, has posted an interesting blog entry on font licensing. Ooh. I know what you're thinking. Font licensing. How exciting does that sound? Okay, it might not sound like the most exciting thing in the world, but potentially it could be. Because Richard has spotted a press release from a prominent font provider. This press release talks about a new type of license. And that license is really designed, is basically a licensing program for font software implementation on server-based applications. So basically, Richard then goes on to explain that this could be a move towards browsers supporting downloadable fonts. So no more will we be limited to that very small set of fonts that exist. This would allow us to use whatever font we wished, rather than being stuck with whatever the user happens to have on his or her desktop. Richard does, however, warn that this could be a reference to Silverlight, because the particular font provider that has released this new approach, it works very closely with Microsoft that produced Silverlight, so it could all be to do with that. However, personally, within the kind of broader context, I'm hopeful that this might lead to something. And what makes me feel that is Opera seem to be moving towards offering downloadable fonts via their browser. So hopefully IE7 and then Firefox will follow suit. So yes, there is an interesting thing. I'm looking forward to finding out whether that really happens or not, because that will really change the face of web design if it does. Finally today, I wanted to mention a technology called Bump Top. Now, you saw this, didn't you? You watched the demo, Marcus.
I like this a lot.
You like it a lot. Definitely. I recently watched a demonstration of the system, and to be honest, I was completely blown away. Basically, Bump Top, I mean, how would you describe it, Marcus?
It's instead of your standard desktop on your computer is 2D. This is a 3D desktop. And you can basically treat your files that are on the desktop like pieces of paper on your real desk. Stack them, crunch them up, move them around, stick them on walls, put them on shelves, all that kind of thing.
I treat them more like a real
environment than a computer environment.
Yeah, it's got like a physics engine behind it, so you can throw the paper around. And the only thing that they didn't seem to do is be able to fold them up into paper aeroplanes. That would have been particularly cool.
I did like the fact you can make them bigger as well, and making them bigger also makes them heavier, so the little files can't bump the big one around.
Yeah, that was very cool. So when I first...
If a bigger file is... It makes it more important. So if something's really important that you deal with, then you just make it bigger,
I mean, where it looked very cool is when those files started to become photographs. Yeah, you could see all photographs at different sizes, and you could throw them around and put them into albums and all that kind of stuff. When I first watched it, mine, I have to confess, it did feel a little bit like a novelty. And probably listening now, you're thinking, nice, cutesy, but what's the real point? But the more I thought about it, the more potential I saw in this as a way of kind of organizing content in a more dynamic and flexible way. But I think what I like most about this interface is that it's not trying to teach us some new method of interaction. Instead, it's trying to replicate something that we're already familiar with. The idea of kind of using metaphors, that we already understand is the staple of interface design. And this kind of really shows that off perfectly. And using metaphors are why things like tabs and desktops and folders are so successful. We know them from the real world. And I think as web designers, we could learn a lot from technologies like this. We should be looking to build applications and websites that make use of established conventions that people understand, rather than always seeking to do the next big thing or innovate in some way. Bump Top is innovative.
That word. New.
I have such problems with that word.
cool. Okay, bump top is cool.
Yeah, but it does it in a way that is instantly accessible to everybody because it's something that we're familiar with. So it's kind of new, but it's not new. It's very clever, very clever. Definitely check it out. The demonstration is really very good. And again, I have a link on the show notes to that. So there you go. That is the news for today. Birdworld.com.
Okay, it's Marcus's bit again. And this really is a client corner, so I could call it client corner, I suppose. I don't know. I'm in so many minds as to which whether we should have my bit or client corner or whatever. What I'm going to look at this week is basically to do with what clients need to do once their site's gone live. Everyone, clients and agencies, seem to understand the principle of not letting sites stagnate. Content should be regularly updated, what are all the things that you can do to keep your site updated? What should you be looking to do? We see a lot of client demands for content management systems that are then often not used for lengthy periods of time. Therefore, I thought it would be useful to look at what options there are for a site manager after the big day when the site goes live. Of course, good not everything subject. Here. Pardon?
I was just going to say, just good subject.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, you sort of sounded like you were muttering away in the distance there. Are you leaning back on your chair, Paul?
I might be.
You are, aren't you?
Sipping
wine after the wonderful figures that we've had through.
And now I'm being fed grapes by my minions.
I'm not going to go any further on that one. Anyway, right, so the first thing, the really obvious one, is news and events. Stories, articles, seminars, fun days, whatever. These are your opportunity to create new content very, very regularly. Clients are invariably perfectly happy with their site when it goes live, which is obvious. They've more often than not spent months on it, fretting over this and tinkering with that. So that once it goes live, they need to spend more time on other aspects of their job that have been neglected, and also that the site actually has never been more up to date. But what often happens is that, say, a couple of months down the line, they realise that new content needs creating, but they can't remember any of the CMS training, and they look at the accompanying CMS manual, which is a big, scary document, and they go, oh, no, I can't do that. And then this happens until basically they go back to the agency, us in this particular case, and say, we're too busy and it's urgent, we need you to add these news stories. And then often, even further on down the line, they book CMS training again. So news and events, what I'm trying to say is they happen in big organisations daily. There's something new to say every day. And what it does is it keeps your hand in as a site owner with your content management system. So always look for new news and events. The next thing that you can look for is basically, or look to update, are shortcuts. Virtually every homepage has various types of shortcut, and also most websites have really important shortcuts throughout the site. But I guess I'm looking at homepage here. And the type of homepage shortcuts that you see on websites are latest news and latest events, which we've got kind of already talked about. But also, the main navigation is often repeated. Like the most important section, there's usually a shortcut to it. If it's a product-based site, then there'll be links directly to certain products, and particularly special offers. There's usually shortcuts to facilities like login or subscribe for our newsletter. Important, deeper content will often have a shortcut to it, and particularly popular topics, which I guess kind of there's a certain amount of crossover there between main navigation and popular topics. But I guess the point I'm making here is that these shortcuts, particularly if they're managed via a content management system, can be rotated. You know, you can change your link to the main navigation, you know, to one of the parts of the main navigation on a daily or weekly or whatever basis. And you're not having to create any new content, but you are giving the feeling that the site's content is changing and it's being refreshed. A really good way of getting an idea of what you should be creating these shortcuts would be by utilizing whatever stats package you've got to see, you know, which areas of the site need a bit of a boost. So you can be a little bit scientific about it as well. I mean, in fact, use everything at your disposal. Obviously, stats packages, but you know, your content suppliers throughout the organisation, your agency support contract if you've got one, internal marketing team. Basically, so you're as informed as you possibly can be with what you should be promoting on your homepage. The next thing, and a really simple thing to update, again without a lot of effort involved, is your imagery. I really encourage people, particularly with new stories, events, I guess news stories in particular, is to include imagery in them. It's so easy to just kind of like fire out a couple of paragraphs on blah, 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 blah. I mean, we're even slightly guilty of it in Headscope. There's a new site launch. It's so easy just to put in a couple of paragraphs about this new site launch, but, oh, that means I've got to go and do some, you know, I've got to create some images, some screenshots from the site, and we have a particular type of template that I have to use, and I can't find it. But it really does add an awful lot to any kind of page on the site to add particularly relevant imagery. But you can also update the main banner imagery on the main sections. You might need an agency to get involved to do that. But that can really rejuvenate the design of the site. Even though you haven't really changed anything, all you're doing is changing the images. So again, just don't leave your images for the next 3 years. Change them regularly. I've kind of the next point I've touched on already, but the title I've given myself here is communicate. Keep your eyes open to what's happening within your company or organisation or whatever. There may be new things happening that isn't inside your particular sphere, but they would really add value to the website. So just make yourself and your role known to everyone. Make sure that everyone within the organisation knows that you're responsible for the website and that you really need as much new, fresh content as possible. You could even do things like send out questionnaires or surveys asking people what they want to see on the site and if they have any particular content that they want to add. Finally, I suppose you need to think big. Don't just, you know, don't lose sight of the main purpose of the site while dealing with smaller things, because you will be dealing with, you know, little news stories along the way. But it may be that the news and the events and that kind of thing aren't the main purpose of the site. Maybe the site may be to promote the brand of the company. So updating the look and feel of the site regularly may be a lot more important than just the updated content. I mean, that's a fairly black and white and unlikely example, but it could be that the look and feel is the most important thing of the site. You know, that's the main function of the site. So that may be something that you need to kind of keep evolving over time, rather than sort of looking to redesign it every 3 years in a kind of big bang kind of way. Excuse me. Alternatively, sales leads may be the site's primary function, in which case you need to keep in touch with the sales department and experiment with ways to boost leads. And you can try things out. Right, we're gonna create particular shortcuts or content that's or methods of getting people to sign up for things. And see whether it really is actually effective or not. So I guess from that point of view, you're looking at just sort of keeping an eye on the main purpose of the site rather than just dealing with the sort of little bits of content that you're going to have to deal with. Looking at sales leads kind of touches on the other really big area to do with managing a site, which is promoting the site. And that's such a big kind of area in itself that I think we'll have to look at that in a separate post another time, or a separate article another time. So I think that'll do me for this week. I've rambled on for long enough.
Very good. Although I am now depressed.
Why is that then?
Well, while you were rambling and I wasn't really listening, I suddenly occurred to me why the 24,000 isn't as good as your venue of 20,000 people.
Why is that?
Well, because your 20,000 people paid to come and see you. While no one pays to see me, do they?
I did think that earlier. At that 20,000 people, I don't think people did pay. I think it was a big event. It was in London.
Ah, now we get to the truth.
Paid to buy the album back in the day, or downloads, you know.
Yeah, right.
So, shush yourself.
So I'm still not famous. But I'm still going to do the TV program. And I'm looking forward to hearing from the TV director that listens to this program.
So am I.
I'm sure there must be one. Yes. Anyway, right. Let's move on. Bugwrite.com. So I figured it's been a while since we've had a listener question. So I'm going to go with a question from Simon that I thought was excellent question and very worth addressing. So this is what Simon had to say.
Okay, Headscapers, here goes. I hear lots of questions about the technical and business side of web design, but what I don't hear, try not to yawn, Marcus, is how do the already technical amongst us become better designers? Maybe being a visual thing, this just won't work on an audio podcast. But hey, at least you could give us your top 5 ways to grow artistically. Over to you.
Now, the first thing to say is, doesn't Simon sound like Mr. Smith out of The Matrix?
God, yeah, he does, doesn't he?
Let's play him again. Maybe I think him. We need to play him again.
Okay, Headscapers, here goes. I hear lots of questions about the technical and business side of web design.
See, that just sounds so much like...
It's that bit, the technical and business side of web design.
Business side.
Yeah, wow.
Scary stuff. So obviously we have to answer his question for fear he infects the podcast. So yes, good question, Simon. Thank you very much for that. Much appreciated. In an ideal world, designers would design and developers would develop. However, we don't live in an ideal world, and from time to time we all end up swapping each other's roles. The problem is there's a lot of tutorials and articles showing designers how to develop, but very little showing developers how to design. So that's what we're going to look at. First things first, I'm not going to be able to teach you good design practice in, you know, the 5-10 minutes that I speak now, or longer, depending on how much I waffle. That comes with time, training, and to some degree, I'm sorry to break it to you, Simon, talent. However, although I cannot make you an expert designer, I can offer you some kind of advice to avoid the major pitfalls I sometimes see developers fall into. So before I plunge headfirst into specific tips, I'd like to start by sharing some more general comments based on my observation of when developers do design. It's like when animals attack, isn't it? When developers design. Hopefully, these will help you think more as a designer and think about design as being more than just arranging pixels. So the first thing I want to talk about is the need to empathize. In many ways, developers work in a world of absolutes. A piece of code either works or it doesn't. So your world as developers tends to be very literal and very straightforward. Computers are in many ways easy to understand. People, on the other hand, are a very different matter. We're messy things, full of contradictions and inconsistencies. And this is a kind of world that designers wade around in. And designers are trying to engage with people, and to do that, they empathize with them. They try to put themselves in the shoes of their user to really understand how they think and how they approach a problem. One of the most common mistakes I see developers make is that they fail to empathize in this kind of way. To a lesser or greater extent, they perceive the user as being kind of similar to themselves. They make assumptions about the user's motivations and abilities based on their own experiences. They often misunderstand what the user is trying to achieve. And so if I could give only one piece of advice to Simon or any other developers listening, it would be to encourage you to empathize with your users. Really try to kind of get inside of your users' heads. Are they in a hurry? Do they have a specific aim? What's their outlook on life? Will they have kids clamoring for their attention while they're surfing your site? Really try and get inside their heads, as it will definitely help. The next thing I want to do a touch on is working with graphic applications like Photoshop. Because the temptation is to think, I have to do some design, that means I need to open Photoshop. After all, that's what designers use. And of course, this is entirely true. Designers do use graphic applications like Photoshop or Freehand. However, I would suggest that unless you're already familiar with these kinds of applications, you're just going to add more complexity to the problem. You know, it's hard enough to apply the principles of good design without learning a new application on top of it. You know code. That's what you know as a developer. So work with code. Build your site using CSS and XHTML, as these are the tools you're familiar with. Sure, it won't lead to outstanding design, but that's not the aim of the exercise, and that's what I want to discuss next. Don't try to be great, try and be invisible. Don't try and produce creative, I've got to say that word again, or innovative. Why can't I say that word? Don't try and create a great piece of design. Designers find that hard enough to do, let alone somebody with very little experience in that area. The danger is that if you try and do this, you'll instead create something that maybe some people absolutely love, but the majority completely hate. Instead, play safe. Try and make your design invisible. A good piece of design will not impress, but neither will it offend. The idea is that the user will not notice it. They'll just use it. If the user doesn't acknowledge that you have produced a piece of design, it means that it hasn't caused them a problem, and that's a good thing. Sure, you're not going to win any design awards, but, you know, that isn't very likely anyway. Sorry to break it to you. Okay, so enough of the kind of airy-fairy advice. Let's get specific. How do you go about making good design invisible enough for it not to cause offense? Well, I can suggest five areas that you want to pay particular attention to. Obviously, you could write reams on each of these, but let's keep it simple and easy to implement. So let's start with typography. The key to good typography is constraint and consistency. Avoid using too many typefaces, normally one or two is enough. Also, avoid having too many variations in size and weight and things like that. Only use size and weight to emphasize the hierarchy of your content. The larger and the bolder the type, the more important the content. Also, try to be consistent in your application of typography. If something is a certain size and weight on one page, make sure it's the same on another. And although CSS makes this relatively easy, watch out when you're working with EMS because of the various inheritance problems involved in that. Finally, don't just think about type itself, but also things like line height and line length. Don't allow text to become too long. Between 40 and 60 characters is probably about right, because it becomes hard to read if you have long line lengths. Also, add some white space between lines of text, because it will make the page feel more spacious, which brings us nicely onto the subject of white space. White space is a not-so-secret weapon of good design. For simplicity's sake, I think a good rule of thumb is to add more white space than you're naturally inclined to do. White space improves legibility and gives a sense of simplicity and communicates a feeling of openness and style. In order to limit scrolling, we often cram in as much content as possible. We often squeeze out the white space. Now resist this temptation. Be generous with your paddings and your margins and your line height, and don't be afraid of empty parts of the screen. Often developers feel this need to fill up empty space. Resist that. Okay, let's look at grid systems very briefly. You often hear people complaining that a website looks boxy, but I would suggest for your purposes as a developer that actually boxes are good. A good website should have a strong underlying structure of columns and rows. It helps the user identify the hierarchy and communicate a sense of order to the site. Now, although a good designer will break out of a grid, he will always have the grid still underneath that he uses as a reference point. Think about how many columns your site should have. Ensure that you apply that consistently across the whole site, but don't be afraid to occasionally span across multiple columns. Also, ensure elements are placed consistently in this grid from page to page, so do not move elements around, especially navigational elements like menus and search. A grid may seem restrictive and not very creative, but it's essential to good design. Let's talk about color. Working with colour is particularly tricky, and so I'd suggest that where possible you avoid making too many choices on colour. Even good designers will struggle getting a good colour palette. Your best bet is to turn to an automated colour creator like Cooler, and again I'll put a link in the show notes. I think you say it Cooler. You can either choose from one of the existing palettes that are there, or you can enter a base colour, which is normally a corporate colour that you've been given or whatever, and it will produce a palette based on that. Notice that Cooler only provides five colours in its palette, and this is good practice. Resist the temptation to use too many colours. Apart from the BOAG World site, where I was just being silly and had hundreds of colours for no apparent reason, I tend to use a very limited colour palette. One nice little trick, however, is to use a strong contrasting colour to highlight important content. Because it is a contrasting colour, it stands out and makes the content that's in that colour stand out from the rest of the site. As far as imagery is concerned, I think that developers tend to shy away from using imagery. And I guess in some ways this isn't a bad thing. It's easy to get imagery wrong, but I would probably encourage you to be a little bit more adventurous than most developers seem to be. Imagery is a great way to draw a user's eye to certain key content that you want to highlight. Now, selecting imagery can be tricky, and so a few suggestions that will point you in the right direction might be avoid animation, choose images with a strong foreground element, compress your images so they download fast, but don't overdo it so that they look rubbish. Use faces because people are naturally drawn to them. And above all, avoid clip art illustrations. Yes. I'm sure that there are many more I could have written on that list, but that's what springs to mind immediately. So there you go. Hopefully that's helped a little. Obviously, there's a lot more that could be said, but that should at least get you started off, and I hope that was useful, Simon. If you do want to take it a step further and improve your design skills, then you might want to check out Jason Beard's book, The Principles of Beautiful Web Design. And again, I'll put a link in the show notes to that. So there you go. Let's move on.
Bugwrite.com.
Okay, so I've decided to do, well, not to do an Ask the Expert section this week, but to do a review instead. Unfortunately, because me and Marcus waffle quite a lot, we don't have time for both segments every week, so I'm going to mix and match from time to time. Now, the reason that I've decided not to do an Ask the Expert is because I want to review Bulletproof Ajax by Jeremy Keith. I read it about 6 months ago, but because we've had so many Ask an Expert, so I haven't really had an opportunity to talk about it on the show until now. Now, the book is designed to be a kind of sequel to Jeremy's previous book, which is DOM Scripting, which was written as an introduction to JavaScript specifically for designers rather than developers. And Bulletproof Ajax is written in a very similar tone, but the focus is obviously on making, you know, making Ajax applications, but about making them accessible to designers rather than providing technical details you'd expect in a developer's book. So the idea is it gets designers started in producing Ajax. Now, it's a bit tricky, you know, because this is going to sound a little bit negative to begin with, but honestly, it does improve as I go through. I have to confess that when I first picked up the book, I found it a little frustrating. As somebody that bought and learnt JavaScript through Jeremy's first book, I felt a little bit annoyed with the first two chapters, which seemed dedicated to laying the foundations that had already been covered in the previous book that I'd bought. I felt like I was paying twice for the same thing. Now, I'm guessing that the idea was that people could buy this book in isolation without first owning DOM scripting. But I have to say, in my opinion, the amount of detail provided in chapter 1 and 2 wouldn't have made that possible. And you still need a good understanding of JavaScript before you pick up this book. For me, the first two chapters felt a little bit like padding to provide to make what is a short book feel slightly more substantial. However, that criticism set aside, the rest of the book is definitely worth what is a very reasonable price tag.
Blah. You have been, haven't you?
I have been drinking, definitely, yes.
You're on strong painkillers.
Yeah, that's what it is. Let's blame it on that. So, okay. I mean, it's a short book, but it's not very expensive, so that kind of makes up for it, really. And there's no point in putting, you know, padding it out any more than already had been done so. So it is an excellent book, and I would recommend it. Jeremy has an excellent writing style that is clear and engaging. He seems to explain complex topics in a manner where you kind of wonder what all the fuss is about, really. You come away from the book thinking, well, this Ajax stuff is easy, and wondering what all the fuss is about. Now, admittedly, he only covers the basics, but it's enough to get you producing the kind of Ajax applications most designers would like to build. Now, it's probably not enough in there to teach you how to build Gmail, but it's certainly enough for the majority of sites, and it's been enough for the kind of thing that I do in my job. But what I like about the book is that Jeremy doesn't shy away from the more complex underlying issues surrounding Ajax. In particular, he talks about accessibility and ensuring that your applications work with JavaScript disabled. He does this through a technique called Hijax, and we probably need to get him on the show at some point to explain it. And I'm not going to even try and explain it in detail here, except to say it relies on the server doing most of the heavy lifting. So all the kind of processing and calculations and complex stuff is done on the server side instead. Now, I've actually been applying the principles taught in this book, and I have to say that Hijax works incredibly well. All the complex stuff is handled by the developers on the server side, so I get to focus on how the information is returned to the user, which is obviously, as a designer, what I'm interested in. Ajax is kind of a funny area because it sits between the client side and the server side, and it leaves designers and developers wondering who's responsible for what. While using the Hijax approach that Jeremy talks about in his book, the division becomes much clearer. So, would I recommend this book? Well, as with DOM scripting, I think the book that he wrote previously, I think it depends on who you are. If you're a designer who's already read Jeremy's first book and would like to start producing Ajax applications, then absolutely, yes, I would recommend it. However, if you haven't read the first book, then I suggest that you do this first, unless you're already confident with producing unobtrusive JavaScript. If you're a developer, on the other hand, then my recommendation is to steer clear. This book is not meant for you, and you'll find it frustratingly lightweight in places. So there you go. I finally got around to reviewing that book. I've been threatening to do so for ages. So I think that about wraps up today's show. It seems to have flown by today. Probably we've been talking forever, but never mind. Marcus, do you have a joke for us this week?
I have another list of really very funny things from Ian. Dear old Ian. Family Fortunes answers. Now, for those of you who don't know what Family Fortunes is, it's a TV show where you basically have two families who are, you know, head-to-head questions to win a prize. And it usually starts off by the host of the show getting two of them up and asking them a question, and the first person to answer I'm not explaining myself very well at all. They've gone out and asked these questions to the general public, and there are obviously the most popular answers and less popular answers. Now, if one of these people, when they come up on the show, says the most popular answer, then they win the chance to have a go. So you can imagine that you get some pretty dumb answers. A good example would be something a blind man might use. Answer, a sword.
What? People panic, don't they? That's the funny thing.
Name the capital of France. F. It's just superb. Where is the Taj Mahal? Opposite the dental hospital. There's loads of them. I'll do some more next week. But a couple of favourites here. The largest Spanish-speaking country in the world. Barcelona. Presenter. I was really after the name of a country. Contestant says, I'm sorry, I don't know the names of any countries in Spain. And finally, the capital of Australia, and it's not Sydney. Contestant, Sydney. Anyway, loads more of those. So they did make a giggle. Thank you, Ian.
There we go. Thank you, Marcus. Those were good ones. I like those. Just a quick mention that about the 100th episode of BOAG World. We've calculated that it should happen sometime in mid-October. And I just wanted to give you a heads up that we're intending to have a bit of a party up in London. So keep listening, because there's going to be more information on that over the coming weeks and months. As normal, check out the forum at boagworld.com/forum for loads of great conversations and support and places where you can get your questions answered about web design. Check out the show notes at boagworld.com/podcast, select show 85, and I think that about wraps everything up. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll speak to you again next week. Goodbye.